Next case is 04-1101, Estate of Grace L. Colling versus the Estate of Garnard H. Colling.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Mr. Whitman, let wait till I call on you, please.
I'm sorry.
Now, Mr. Panza.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Richard Panza. I'm from Avon, Ohio, and I represent the appellant, the Estate of Grace Colling. For the last 80 years, this court has recognized and dealt with rights involved in the creation, existence, and termination of joint and survivorship accounts. In determining the legalities involved in those accounts, and particularly in determining the rights of joint tenants, both pre- and post-mortem, this court has recognized and adopted certain presumptions which afford the account holders a certain degree of stability, predictability in the creation of these accounts. Most recently, this court held in Wright v. Bloom that extrinsic evidence amounting to the realities of ownership is permissible in determining joint tenants' rights, inter vivos rights, in regards to property in these accounts. In 1978, this court held in Vetter v. Hempton that absent any evidence of the realities of ownership, the joint tenants to these accounts share equally. Furthermore, in Vetter, this court found that the burden of proof rests with the individual seeking to impose the realities of ownership over the presumptions that have been developed by this court.
In your view, does the term realities of ownership, which we find in Thompson, does it refer to the creation of the joint account, the intention of the parties in creating the account, or does it apply to the contributions that were made to the account? Some of the cases seem to indicate that that term is used in determining what the intention of the parties was when the owners of the account was when they.
I think historically it was used to define the intent of the parties in the creation of the account, because the way the law has developed in regards to this, these joint and survivorship accounts, it was a matter of contract which was eventually extrinsic evidence of the realities of ownership was eventually permitted, commencing in 1949 with the Union Property case, but. When you consider the term net contribution, what in fact you are doing, Your Honor, is defining each respective joint tenant's proportional contribution to those respective accounts. You are saying the term applies to net contributions as well. You are asking one tenant to prove, joint tenant, to prove his or her contribution to that account. So I believe it is a term which is synonymous and can be used as synonymous with net contribution.
Mr. Panza, is the law relatively clear in this field, and has it been misapplied and we have to fix an error that was made here? Or are you asking us to write a new law here?
I think it was relatively clear until the opinion of the Ninth District Court of Appeals.
So you're here because you think the Ninth District got it wrong and should have applied the law differently, and
absolutely.
you want us to fix the mistake.
Absolutely. The Ninth District got it totally wrong. There is absolutely no precedent for what the Ninth District did. There is absolutely no precedent to extend the principles of constructive trust law before the fiduciary breach. There's no case which supports it. And that's where the Court of Appeals went wrong.
So when the court said that the burden falls to one of the tenants to prove where that money came from, the law is all in place. They just sort of misapplied it.
Yes, I think they misinterpreted it completely. They absolutely misinterpreted it.
So, counsel, are you saying the misinterpretation involves the requirement that tracing of the contributions or tracing of the assets was a requirement. I got the impression that the court determined that it was insufficient tracing to...
Well, actually, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I apologize if you didn't finish your question.
Insufficient tracing to determine with the requisite level of certainty what the realities of ownership were.
Well, I think the court, that's exactly what the Court of Appeals said. The problem is that they utilized probably the most stringent form of analysis one can imagine without ignoring, by the way, all forms of circumstantial evidence or direct evidence that would prove by sufficient probative force the term net contribution. What they did is they extended the very, very severe principle of tracing that applies to constructive trust law to the requirements of proving net contribution. There is a reason for the stringency of that analysis in constructive trust law. You are following the properties from the fiduciary breach into the hands of the constructive trustee. That is why the evidence below, you will find a stipulation of the parties, which stipulates that the money that was taken out in 1996 by Garnard Cowling was traced into the hands of the constructive trustees. Once that was done, our duty to trace was over. However, the term tracing, Your Honor, I mean, it is a term that can apply to all forms of contribution. I mean, if you, and I'm sure you have read the record, you'll see that our expert, Mark Bober, thinks he traced the property into the hands of the joint accounts through the sale of the property in 1993 and the sale of the residence in 1992. You'll see him say in a number of places, and this testimony is uncontradicted, yes, I traced this property from there into here, and I double-checked by computing a 3.73 interest rate over the particular period of time. So where the Court of Appeals went wrong is to apply the same stringent tracing standard that usually occurs from the time of the fiduciary breach back to the acquisition of the asset. In fact, I find it difficult to determine exactly what the Court of Appeals is saying. But one thing I know for certain, the Court of Appeals setting up this kind of a stringent standard to prove net contribution in a 30-year marriage with a joint survivorship savings account, when in fact that joint survivorship savings account is utilized as the principal savings account in the marriage, sets up almost a conclusive presumption which favors the first party who gets to the account and withdraws the assets.
All right, counsel, so then partly in response to your question from Justice O'Donnell, you are suggesting that the Ninth District Court simply got this wrong. It has to be a little more than that for us to be able to rule effectively on a case, something more than error correction. What rule of law would you have us articulate here? Because from what it sounds to me like, you're saying that tracing or the requirement for tracing of the assets goes forward from the breach to the establishment of the constructive trust rather than being applied from the inception of the corpus or not corpus, but the assets to the format before it was breached.
Your Honor, when I say they got it wrong, I meant they set up a new standard which ignored 80 years of set law set down by this court. I mean they ignored and went away from evidence sufficient, which need only be of sufficient and probative force, allowing direct and circumstantial evidence to prove net contribution, and raise the bar to a situation to make it totally impossible for any joint tenant to sustain. When I say they got it wrong, I meant they created a new standard by shifting the burden of proof away from what this court said was required in Vetter versus Hampton back to the victim. When I mean they got it wrong, I mean they raised the weight of evidence from a preponderance to clear and convincing for virtually no reason at all, simply because they felt dedicated to follow the principles of constructive trust law. When I say they got it wrong, I mean the only way they could get around the substantial and overwhelming evidence of contribution in the trial court is to declare all of it, insufficient. And that's precisely what they did. The Ninth District Court of Appeals knew they were bound to, in fact, weigh the evidence in favor of the trial court, because this is a review of a directed verdict and a JNOV. The Court of Appeals admits that the only way they can do that, the only way they can, in fact, reverse, in my estimation, Your Honor, is to create a new standard of evidence, which they did do. That standard of evidence contradicts 80 years of Ohio Supreme Court decisions in regards to joint and survivorship accounts. I think it is absolutely imperative that this court reverse the Ninth District of the Court of Appeals. That's what I meant when I answered Justice O'Donnell's question. I don't think there's a thing right about the Ninth District Court of Appeals decision. I don't think there's a thing right about the Ninth District Court of Appeals analysis. I think when they cite Thompson as to support a tracing concept, I don't think the word tracing appears in Thompson.
Counsel, you suggest they improperly shifted the burden of proof.
Yes, Your Honor.
In at what point or in what fashion?
Well, I think heretofore this court has said that the burden of proving the realities of ownership rest with the individual who's seeking to overcome the presumptions afforded those accounts, such as each joint tenant owns them 50-50. What the Court of Appeals did is say it's up to the victim, it's up to Grace Cowling to prove net contribution, when in fact it should have been up to Garner Cowling to prove that he contributed 100% to the joint accounts, because that's what he took. That was his burden. The court did not.
Who was the plaintiff here?
We were. We had the burden going forward with the evidence.
Right.
We did. We had the burden of going forward with the evidence, and once we established the joint accounts, once we established our contribution to those joint accounts, that's where our burden rested. It was then on up to Garner Cowling and the constructive trustees to establish Garner Cowling's contributions to those accounts. What has happened here is that Garner Cowling, because he was first in time.
But I guess what I'm asking, yes, suggesting, Your Honor, is you're the plaintiff, and you want to flip the burden over to the defendant.
I don't want to flip the burden of going forward with the evidence that every plaintiff has, Your Honor. That's not what I'm suggesting. What I am suggesting is that the burdens to prove the realities of ownership, in fact, the burdens to prove that Garner Cowling contributed 100% to these joint accounts, because that's what he took, rests with him. The Court of Appeals didn't require that.
You're maintaining that 88% or whatever was hers. Wouldn't it be your burden to prove that at least by a preponderance?
And I did. But if you read the Court of Appeals opinion, they shifted the burden. They did not require any burden on Garner Cowling. My burden as plaintiff, as it always is to go forward with the evidence. And I did do that. But the ultimate burden of the realities of ownership rest with and are required by the individual who has taken the money and who is seeking to set aside the presumptions of joint survivorship accounts.
Okay, that it's at some point that seems counterintuitive to me. I can't quite tell you why, but I mean, you're starting out from a position of this money moved while they were both alive, and it's over here someplace.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed that.
You're starting out with a transaction where the money moved while they're both still alive.
Right.
And it's over here in his children when this litigation starts. I think it takes a certain amount of mental gymnastics to somehow put when that's the world as you find it when you go to court, to somehow put the burden on the people who have the money in their accounts to prove by any burden that it's theirs.
Well, actually, Your Honor, in this kind of situation,
it just seems to me
all they had to prove
as the plaintiff, you've got to prove it isn't.
Well, I think in a contrastive trust situation, when theoretically you're dealing with innocent third parties, at some particular point in time, they have to assert a legal right to the money. They have to assert a legal right to the money. As plaintiff, when I move forward with the evidence, I have to and did prove that Grace Cowling contributed 74% of the joint survivorship accounts. The evidence is overwhelming of that particular fact. At some particular point in time, Garnard Cowling has the burden to establish that the money he took belonged to him. It's just that simple. I'd like to reserve the last few minutes if there are no other questions right now.
Thank you, Mr. Panza.
Thank you, Justice Moore.
Mr. Keyes-Walker.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is John Keyes-Walker. I represent Gary Cowling, Richard Cowling, and their spouses, Diana and Deanna Cowling. My clients were the recipients of these assets in issue from their father, Garnard Cowling. Garnard Cowling transferred part of these assets as gifts during his lifetime, and a number of the assets were also transferred to them through transfer on death accounts. This case is about where a constructive trust is sought, whether the requirement for the tracing of the assets from the hands of the claimant to the hands of the recipients is somehow eliminated when the asset passes through a joint and survivor account. The evidence in this case, contrary to what the appellant says, does not place any specific asset that moved into my client's hands at some point in time in the hands of Grace Cowling. The evidence at trial was that Grace Cowling earned certain sums of money, had available certain sums of money, but there was no link to those sums of money being earned or available actually having been put into the assets, which consisted of shares of stock and various other securities that found their way into the hands of my clients.
Counsel, the case at first blush certainly doesn't seem to pass what is commonly referred to as the smell test. It looks bad initially from the get-go in that all these assets, once she becomes incapacitated, gets transferred out of this joint account into your client's account and then to his children, and none go to her children. But it seems to me that the Court of Appeals gets there by saying because she can't prove A went into account B and from B, therefore, to your client, she fails because there's some commingling along the way, there's some, you know, everybody puts everything together, and because she can't prove specifically dollar for dollar, which is the way I interpret their standard, she loses. Is that what you're interpreting the court to say? That she has to prove A went into B to get A back. And if she proves that A went into B but it got commingled and mixed up over the years, she loses.
Well, I think that's essentially what the Court of Appeals said. And
does that place an impossible burden on couples that have been married forever then?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor.
Does that then allow the spouse that gets a hold of the money first and transfers it to win?
I think what it does, and in this particular circumstance, it requires a claimant to prove their claim.
Let me ask it the other way. If Grace had transferred this money out first, could you have met the burden of proof under this standard that he contributed assets?
I don't believe we ever got to that question, Your Honor. And
but could you have? I mean, you both contributed the money in the same fashion. You both dumped money here, dumped money there, put it together. She takes it out first under this burden that is established by this court. Could your client have met that standard?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know. What I do...
Well, counsel, isn't it, as Mr. Panza was saying, a requisite that and a presumption based on the Court of Appeals opinion, in order for your client to succeed in taking, there's a presumption that he contributed 100% of these dollars. In order for him to be able to take that and then displace it to his children, either through POD accounts or direct gifts?
I'm not sure I'm understanding your question, Your Honor.
The effect of the Court of Appeals opinion here is to allow for your client to, in essence, claim 100% of those dollars and do with them what he wanted to by gifting and establishing payment on death accounts. Are you with me so far?
I'm with you.
Okay. That is presuming then, because there's some inability to actually account, as Justice Stratton said, dollar for dollar, contribution, growth of that dollar, placement of that dollar in this account or that account, you're presuming then, because of that standard set by the appellate court here, that 100% of the dollars go to the first who can clean out the account.
I believe that is correct, Your Honor, that the parties end up setting up this account and allow either of them to draw upon it. And in so doing, they place themselves in that position, either of the parties. Quite frankly, Grace Cowling could have drawn 100%, and the burden would have been on the other side here.
I guess that raises the question, what is the law here that applies? Is Thompson, and we supposedly adopted the Uniform Probate Code. Like, is that still, in your view, is Thompson still good law?
I believe it is, Your Honor. I know there's been some mention of the Vetter case and the what I would call the equal shares presumption, that you begin with a presumption of 50-50. I believe that the Thompson case set that aside and requires that the claimant come forward with some proof of net contribution.
Isn't there a presumption that, citing the section from your brief, a joint account belongs during the lifetime to all parties, to the parties in proportion to the net contributions of each of the sums on deposit, unless there is clear and convincing evidence of a different intent? Is there evidence here of a different intent between the parties? Was there evidence? I mean, in the account document, that one party could take it all if they wanted.
Well, the ability to draw is, of course, the evidence that one party could take it all if they wanted.
But isn't that common in all of these type of accounts? There's no restriction.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. The parties can set up accounts that restrict the ability to draw to one party or the other. They do have that kind of contractual control over the accounts. And that was absent here.
What's the standard format for one of these accounts?
Standard format, unquestionably, is that either party draws and has the ability to draw. But again, as a matter of contract in setting up these accounts, there is an ability to restrict the ability to draw to one individual and still carry out the survivorship function of the account ultimately.
How do they become joint during the lifetime of the tenants when one can't draw? I mean, I can see the survivorship, and those are called pay on death accounts.
Right.
But how do you get a joint and survivorship account when only one can draw on it?
I think you get that under the Thompson case through the proof of the net contribution. And the joint feature is that there has been a contribution.
What difference does that make? If they're the survivorship, they get it on death.
Well, I think we're talking about the during lifetime situation here, Your Honor.
Which then has nothing to do with withdrawal. It has to do when there becomes a necessity to show contribution, such as a divorce or some other kind of occurrence. But not for the withdrawal feature. Because that's irrelevant here. If you're saying that is the same animal, so to speak, where you're limited on what you can withdraw, maybe it has no bearing whatsoever. But you're saying because they both could withdraw here is further proof of the authority for what Mr. Colling did.
Yes. Yes.
And when you say the intent of the parties in this type of account is paramount, is the court allowed to consider evidence at all that one party becomes incapacitated and only thereafter does the second party remove it all and give it to his children? Is the court allowed to look at that, or is that factor irrelevant?
Well, I think the intent of the parties is established at the time the account is set up, in the manner in which the account is set up. And some later incapacity wouldn't really have a bearing on that, Your Honor.
Are you allowed to show then at all that you would never have intended for your spouse to give all this money just to their children when you set this account up, that you intended to share it? Is that permitted as evidence?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Again, I think we go to the time when the account is established, and if the ability is for one or the other party to draw the entirety, what they do with it from that point forward really isn't relevant.
If that's correct, then there's no case ever, right? You can't have a case where two parties, husband and wife, both competent, set up a joint account, put in whatever assets at the time, put more in later, his, hers, doesn't matter. Because they knew or should have known when they set it up that either one of them can take it all out at any time, you could never have a case such as this successfully maintained where one spouse during the lifetime, when they're both living, one spouse drains it all out, even unbeknownst or without consent or permission, any of those things, without specific knowledge as to that draining transaction, I'll call it. No case ever.
Well, there is always the case, of course, under the Thompson standard, that there is proof of net contribution, that there is some proof mustered by the claimant party who says the account, the person drawing on the account took more than that person's contribution. Here's my contribution. Here's my proof of that contribution.
Well, isn't that what Mr. Panza has argued, that he was able to establish 74% of the assets had been contributed by his client, and that met a prima facie burden of proof, which shifted it to your client to say, wait a minute, that's not right. These are my assets, and you never met your burden of proof. I think that's the essence of what his case is, and you haven't addressed that.
That's the argument that's made, Your Honor, but the simple fact is that there was no proof that the contribution was actually made to these accounts. Instead, the proof mustered at trial was that I had these dollars out there earned during my lifetime or acquired during this 30-year marriage, just as Garner.
The sale of the residence and the like of that.
Right. The money was out there somewhere, and therefore it must have been utilized to contribute to this particular account. Now, the parties had assets, parties had assets beyond these particular accounts. And indeed, Grace Cowling had limited partnership interests, certificates of deposit in her own names. What the proof mustered at trial did was said these sums were available. It didn't say they went to these accounts.
So you're back to the dollar per dollar proof that this court appeals opinion seemed to require. Clear and convincing, dollar for dollar is the standard that they set up, correct?
Clear and convincing, dollar for dollar is the standard they set up, but even by a preponderance standard, Your Honor, there was not sufficient proof.
But the court appeals didn't analyze under preponderance, though.
No, court did not analyze. Analyzed under, I believe, a clear
and
convincing.
That is what Thompson requires, preponderance.
Yes.
Right. Sufficient but, probative value would be probably equivalent to preponderance. Certainly not clear and convincing.
I don't know what sufficient probative value means. That's certainly a term that was utilized in one of the cases. Whether that standard that this court addressed, since it didn't say preponderance or clear and convincing, it merely said sufficient probative value, I don't know what the standard was that was applied there. But the issue of the evidence was, I have a dollar available. I might have spent the dollar on housing for myself, on food, on fuel, on clothing. I might have spent the dollar to buy the limited partnership that I own in my individual name, or I might have spent the dollar to put into the assets.
Counsel, it seems in part that both sides are saying this just comes down to a dispute about the evidence. You don't even, I guess you're not disputing the law.
Well, in some respect, the evidentiary standard certainly not being met is a significant issue here. And it's the issue that the Court of Appeals ruled upon.
You agree with Grace's contention that she can go after these assets, or her family can go after these assets that were transferred during her lifetime out of the joint account?
When you say go after them, Your Honor.
Try to establish what was there that was hers that was taken out without her knowledge.
And indeed, that's what occurred, and she failed. The evidence was not present.
Would she have succeeded if it had been the Court of Appeals had not done a dollar for dollar clear and convincing standard?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay. But the court never reached that issue because it didn't set that standard, correct?
I would have to agree with you, Your Honor.
You've used your time, Mr. Keyes-Walker.
Pardon?
Thank you.
Mr.
Panza, you've saved 30 seconds of your time.
Quite accurately stated, Your Honor. The rule of Thompson applies. Nobody's disputing the fact. This case is about what is sufficient evidence to prove net contribution, and if neither party proves net contribution, what happens to the money? That's what this case is about. The rule of law that I am proposing, Justice Lenziger, is that constructive law tracing is inapplicable when proving net contribution. Clear and convincing evidence is not required when proving net contribution. The rule of Thompson applies. Circumstantial, direct or circumstantial evidence of net contribution is admissible. The evidence in the trial court below was overwhelming concerning Grace Cowling's contribution. This court must reverse the Court of Appeals and reinstate the constructive trust imposed upon the constructive trustees. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please, to the court.
All rise.